If you want access to bonus episodes, reading lists for every series of Empire, a chat community, discounts for all the books mentioned in the week's podcast, ad-free listening, and a weekly newsletter, sign up to Empire Club at www.empirepoduk.com.
Sag mal, hast du bei der Steuer auch diesen Schulflashback? Einfach irgendwas raten und dann hoffen, dass es stimmt?
Boah, nee, gar nicht. Wieso, Steuer ist so mein Safe Space?
Du meinst, damit ist alles sicher?
Ja, genau. Wieso, Steuer ist so die Steuer-App, die dich einfach versteht. Egal ob Studium, Job oder Umzug.
Stimmt, krass. Fühlt sich gar nicht wie Steuern an.
Steuern erledigt?
Safe.
Mit Wieso, Steuer?
10, 9. Abbruch! Was ist los?
Hab Nutella vergessen!
Nicht so ernst.
Schmeckte schon himmlisch, bevor wir auf dem Mond waren. Nur Nutella ist Nutella.
Du kümmerst dich jeden Tag um andere, um dich und um dein Zuhause. Du kümmerst dich, wenn es drauf ankommt. Und weil du dich kümmerst, kümmern wir uns um das Geld, das du dafür brauchst. Damit Kredit so einfach wird wie noch nie. Hol auch du dir jetzt deinen Kredit auf auxmoney.com. auxmoney. Kredit einfach online.
Hello and welcome to Empire with me, Anita Anand.
And me, William Dalrymple.
Now, if you are listening in the future, I should just tell you, we are recording this days after a series of earthquakes hit southeastern Turkey near the border with Syria. And as we speak, rescue teams are still desperately trying to locate survivors in pockets beneath the rubble. Our minds are turning to those who are now homeless. The conditions are freezing. You're seeing this, if you're listening to this at the time the podcast comes out, you'll know it's cold in Turkey and Syria, and they could do with all the help they could get.
So if you're minded to give, we will be putting two websites on our programme description, one for Disasters Emergency Committee and the other for International Rescue. Please give generously.
Yeah, and every little bit helps, as they say. £30 could provide blankets for 6 people to keep warm. £50 could provide emergency food for 2 families for 10 days. £100 could provide emergency shelter for 4 families. And as William says, we're going to put those links on our programme page. So just do what you can.
I've had so much hospitality from the people of southeast Turkey and Syria. When you go around those regions, you're very much aware that this is a place where earthquakes are part of its history. The whole town of Antioch, Antakya in modern Turkey, which was once the second city of the Roman Empire, there's barely a standing pillar from the Roman past now because it was wiped out in a 6th century earthquake and everyone in the town went with it. But Alita, you've actually had firsthand experiences of covering earthquakes, haven't you? You went to the Buj earthquake in 2002.
It, 2001 it was in Gujarat. And yeah, no, it actually made me decide I wasn't going to be a foreign correspondent because I just didn't have the mettle for it. So, you know, the kind of amazing bravery of those journalists who go in and cover what is left after an earthquake of this magnitude. The one in Buj was similar, actually. I think it was 7.6 magnitude. And more than 20,000 people died there. And the thing I remember most of all is, you know, you're standing in a place where photographs, for some reason, photographs in children's schoolbooks get pushed to the top of the rubble. And all you see is sort of like the handwritten scrawl of small people who aren't here anymore. So I don't, it's, I mean, it's awful. And awful, so awful for those who survived, the trauma for those people who have to now piece their lives back together. One thing I remember very, very clearly is a woman in Buj who was just so traumatized. She was just taking pebbles by the side of the road and stacking them one on top of the other. And so, yes, that's why I don't do that job, that particular foreign affairs job.
And we've been busy over the last 6 weeks telling stories from Turkish and Ottoman history. And of course, quite a lot of Turkish history has been wiped out by that earthquake, most notably the beautiful walls of the castle at Gaziantep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that one goes back, doesn't it? It's a Roman Empire, 2nd, 3rd centuries AD.
Yeah. Byzantine bits, but I think, you know, appropriately for us, very much Ottoman superstructure, what you see today from outside, which has been relayed on so many news photographs, the before and after pictures of that castle. Mm. That is indeed Ottoman.
Yeah. Anyway, look, in short, this is a massive blow to humanity, to history, to everything, whatever you can do. it would be helpful. So again, we are going to put those donation websites on our site for the DEC Fund and for International Rescue.
Our last podcast was Evely Çelebi, who actually visited Gaziantep and described that castle. And so I think it's a very appropriate moment for anyone that's enjoyed this podcast to give generously to one of the disaster emergency funds looking after survivors.
Hello and welcome to Empire with me, Anita Arnon.
And me, William Durrumpool.
Now, William, last week we got quite immersed in the mad, mad world of Evely Çelebi.
Who I've been reading this week. I have to say, it's available in an Eland book, The Highlights of Evely Çelebi, published by our friend Barnaby, who was on a month ago on this podcast. And I highly recommend it for anyone, particularly anyone heading towards the Mediterranean this summer. It's a wonderful read.
It's disgusting, by the way. Can we just for a moment just dwell on the fact it is just filthy? There are bits of it which are filthy and disgusting. And I would like to apologise for those who ventured it. We warned you. So those people have been in touch on Twitter saying you can't eat a chicken sandwich anymore. That is not our fault. We have nothing to answer for there. So, you know, you were told.
Anyway, this week we have another travel writer who has no chicken-related stories, and you can tuck into all the chicken momos or sandwiches that you wish this week without any difficulty, because we have the wonderful Lady Mary Wortley Montagu.
Okay, we have the wonderful historian and travel writer Katie Hickman here with us to discuss Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, that's how you say it quickly, who is this extraordinary creature of the 1700s. Now, why should we be concerned, Katie Hickman, somebody who I consider to be my kind of gal, really?
Well, she was lots of things, but she was our first female travel writer, apart from anything else. And she wrote a series of letters from Constantinople, which made her not famous in her day, but very, very famous indeed after they were published after her death.
And you've written beautifully about her in your book, Daughters of Britannia, and you've actually amassed quite a few wonderful women.
She's on your front cover.
My front cover. She absolutely is. Not only on my front cover, but she's on my front cover dressed in Turkish dress. And the extraordinary thing about that painting, I think it's a beautiful painting, but when I was sort of wondering whether I was going to use it or not, all the men who looked at it went, "Oh my God, she's so ugly."
Oh.
And all the women said, "Oh my God, she's got the most interesting face I've ever seen."
Well, you obviously had a male designer in your American edition, because they've cut her head off. And what you see is Lady Mary's sort of headless body. You see her chest in the American.
That can't be right.
Oh, I think someone needs to have a word with somebody. Katie, let's go back to her. So she was born in 1689, and Lady Mary spent her early life in England. What kind of child was she?
Well, she was born into this incredibly aristocratic family. So she was born Mary Pierrepont. Her father was successively an earl, a marquis, and then a duke. And her mother was also very aristocratic. She was a daughter of the Earl of Denby and also extremely rich. So Lady Mary was born into, you know, not so much with a silver spoon in her mouth as a solid gold ladle in her mouth. Aristocratic, rich. And when she was young, she was also supposed to be very beautiful. And so she had all these incredible blessings. But there were two things about her. First of all, you know, she was born a woman, and she was born very clever. And clever women in the early 18th century, you know, got a pretty raw deal, because nobody thought that their education was very important. And so she was hardly educated at all when she was very young. She said she had one of the worst educations in the world. And so although she became extremely literary, she was totally self-taught, to the degree that, you know, she had read all of the playwrights and novels and so forth by the time she was about 14, and became obsessed with Ovid's Metamorphoses and had to teach herself Latin.
Under her bed sheets at night with a torch?
No, she's in a cupboard. But also, she had a, I mean, you know, her dad, who do you mind me saying, sounds like a proper git.
Yes,
just didn't think that she was worth educating. But he had a very well-furnished library. So he was one of those sort of leading Whigs of the country. So he, you know, the outward appearance of being literary. But she said, she writes that, you know, between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., nobody would go in there or be in the house. So she would just have free reign of this library and actually read books that were untouched. So you can just, and her greatest ambition was to be an abbess. So she could just sit in a corner and read. And learn things.
Yes, and be and not be bothered and not, you know, not have to marry if she didn't want to. But the thing that, so this is a bit of a kind of dogleg fact, but it's quite an interesting one, that the only thing that she was really taught in a solid way was the art of carving. And so she had a carving master who went to the house three times a week. This was
this kind of regular thing in the Denby family, that or the Pierpont family, that sculptures were brought in to...
It was a princely art. It was a princely art and very much tied to the art of chivalry.
You're talking about carving meat. You're not talking about carving statues. You're talking about the roast,
I thought you meant she had a sort of hunky sculptor brought in to teach her how to...
No. Carving meat carvings.
I knew you misunderstood. Yeah.
And there were whole manuals given over to the, you know, the correct way in which you would carve your, you know, chickens, you know, fowl, fish, you know, an ordinary meat as well. And so she was very, you know, this was something that in an aristocratic household, you had to have somebody who was able to, it was a sort of performative art. It was almost like a piece of theatre. So she wouldn't dine with her father and his political friends, but she would be brought in to do this piece of sort of performance art almost. And this was a strange fact that I discovered the other day, that there is something called the Hereditary Grand Carver of England. And her, strange but true.
Only in England.
Her maternal grandfather, who was the Earl of Denby, was the Hereditary Grand Carver of England. So this could be a reason why she was given this strange form of education. She wasn't taught Latin, but she was taught how to carve a jolly good roast.
You just thought this is a heading
fowl.
For a sort of Hannibal Lecter ending, this story. I'm glad to say she doesn't use this art in any sort of aggressive manner.
But it's also, you know, she's been groomed to be a wife and a lady of a house. I mean, the grooming starts really early, because her dad said git. At the age of seven, he's part of the Kit Kat Club, which is this sort of louche group of Whigs who get together and drink quite a lot.
The Grand Whigs with Vanbrugh and all these sort of, the great minds of their day.
Grand but drunken.
But they do this thing where every year they toast the Belle of Britain, or, the most beautiful woman in England. And they toast her, the finest filly, age seven. Now, there's something not right there, is there?
That's very weird. And she was brought, they said, the other men said, well, we don't know who this young woman is. And so he said, right, well, get her up, get her out of bed. She was, got out of bed, dressed up in all her fine clothes and taken to the tavern where they were having this drinking and toasted as the great beauty. But it was a kind of thing in the 18th century that you gave toasts to the beauties, the sort of beautiful women, many of whom, by the way, were courtesans. Famous courtesans, which obviously she was not in that category, but the sort of looseness, there was a kind of tinge of looseness about the whole notion of toasting a great beauty. Yes, I think you're right. I don't think her father was a particularly great father.
So her father, who doesn't sound like he's one of the great intellectuals of the country either,
no,
decides to marry her off to a man with the most fantastically sort of dim-sounding name, Clotworthy Skeffington. Surely that's a misprint. Can't really be called that.
I think he was called Clotworthy Skeffington, and interesting, almost nothing else is known about him. I think, that people are so stunned by his name when they hear it that they forget all other facts. I think he was the heir to an Irish peerage. And anyway, Lady Mary really did not want to marry this man. She said she'd rather give her hand to the flames, in other words, give her hand to the flames of hell than be married to this man. But she had had all the time while this, her father was trying to force her to marry Clotworthy Skeffington, she had a correspondence, an illicit correspondence with Edward Montagu, Edward Wortley Montagu. Mary had been a friend of his sister. So he had a sister called Anne who died. And after her death, she carried on this correspondence. And it's a sort of curious thing because they debated for several years whether or not they were going to get married. And they actually, he did, go to her father and say, there were sort of marriage negotiations started, but they stumbled on sort of the financial details.
They were haggling. haggling
they
over
were
how much money.
Haggling over her, yeah. Absolutely. And she had this rather sad thing that she wrote. She said, people in my way are sold as slaves, and I cannot tell what price my master will put on me.
If you read the letters of this time, they literally do talk about a £10,000 or a £15,000.
Yeah, they were dynastic, especially in her at her level of society. They were dynastic marriages, which were supposed to be for the sort of consolidation of family finances. And people's feelings, one way or the other, you know, were not really taken into account.
I have a theory about Clotworthy, by the way.
Yes.
Why he changed his name to Brian. I mean, why wouldn't
he?
I'm just saying, if you were called, no, I don't know this, but I'm just saying it's a line of scholarship that ought to be pursued if you're called Clotworthy.
Or do you think his nickname was just Clot?
Clot. So look, Montague, who then does, you know, haggle over, he wants more money because you come with a bride price at that time. So he wants more money to marry the woman he's supposedly in love with. Oh my God. But he's no catch, is he? Katie.
No, he isn't really a cat. I mean, he was a politician. He was fairly aristocratic himself and also quite rich. I mean, his grandfather was the Earl of Sandwich, the first Earl of Sandwich. And his mother, on his mother's side, his mother was illegitimate but extremely rich. And that's how they acquired the name Wortley. That was the condition that they had to add Wortley onto the family name of Montague. And he was a politician. And he had sort of a literary, slightly literary bent to him. He was friends to people like Addison and Steele, the men of letters. And so I think that that may have been one of the attractions. It's actually quite hard to see what the attraction was, because in their letters, they don't really agree about anything. There's an awful lot of haggling about whether she's going to have a dowry or not. And then the question arises, you know, that her father says, no, well, I don't, you know, Wortley Montague is absolutely no good. He won't agree to my terms. So you're going to marry Clotworthy Skeffington. The rest of this story takes on a kind of picaresque novel aspect to it, because there's a slight hitch in the details. I mean, this is a done and dusted deal with Clotworthy Skeffington. The father's agreed to it. They've agreed to all the, you know, the dowry and so forth, but he lives in Ireland. And so the marriage contract had to be returned to Ireland because there was some fault in it. So it had to be, you know, rewritten and re-signed. And so in this tiny little space of time, Edward Montague and Mary Pierpont, as she then still was, decide that they're going to elope together, because that is the only way that she's going to be able to, you know, get out of this hideous marriage. But the elopement goes horribly wrong. So she goes one night, the night they've, you know, that they've agreed on, she goes onto her balcony, sort of shivering on the balcony of her house, but at 6 o'clock in the morning, waiting for Edward Montague. And he doesn't turn up. He doesn't turn up in time to come and rescue her. So then, you know, they're discovered and she's taken pretty much under lock and key in her brother's carriage down to the family house in Wiltshire. And, you know, Edward Montague is, you know, on his horse pursuing them. And they then realise afterwards that they'd actually both spent the night in the same inn without actually realising that the other one was there. And she's then taken on to this house in Wiltshire. And so the whole thing, you know, the whole thing had, you know,
it's sort of Keystone Cops, isn't it? In through one door and out the other.
Totally Keystone Cops, kind of botched job right from the beginning. And she did end up marrying him.
She did. But she also laid out the terms of her relationship with him in a way that is so feminist and so modern, because she talks about love. And she says, I don't know if I do love you. I'll just read you from one of her letters. She says, I don't know whether I can love. And then she sort of lays out her terms of, you know, what she thinks marriage is going to be like. And she says, make no answer to this. If you can like me on my own terms, then that's fine. And that's amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
She knows what she wants. He has prospects. And very soon it becomes apparent that she did make the right decision for her. Just before, you know, Wortley Montague is going to make something of himself, something life-changing happens to the beauty that is Lady Mary. Now, what happens to her the year before they leave Constantinople?
She contracts smallpox, and which the year before has killed her brother. And actually, she very, very nearly dies of smallpox. But she manages to cling on to life, and she does recover, but she has completely lost her looks in the proceeds. And that, you know, for a woman, well, for any woman, but particularly for a woman in her situation, you know, this society figure was a personal catastrophe. And there were, you know, incredibly cruel things were written about her, you know, that
cruel things written by her friends, Katie. I mean, so first of all, just tell us about her circle of friends. She had some really influential names in her circle who were completely beastly to her at this point.
So when she finally came to London, having languished in the north of England for quite some time, at the very beginning of her marriage, which was really a disaster. I mean, it was a completely loveless marriage after, you know, despite the elopement. She came to London and she became very caught up, but both with the Hanoverian court, she was accepted at court, but also she made friends with a lot of literary men, such as most significantly Alexander Pope, the dramatist John Gay as well, and she was part of a sort of literary coterie of principally men. I think she was the only woman there, and it was, you know, this was the age of scandal. So it was the age in which people wrote very freely about one another and they did not pull their punches. And so poor Lady Mary, when she, you know, recovered from this life-threatening disease, she lost all her eyelashes. You know, this was a woman who'd been considered one of the great beauties of London society. And after smallpox, she was no longer a beauty. She'd lost her eyelashes, which never grew back. And also her face was very, very badly pitted. So there was something written about her. They said she was full of pox, but not pitted. In other words, not pitied. You know, people had absolutely no compunction about writing really cruel, vicious things about people. And physical deformity or physical problems were not considered, you know, nobody thought that they were subjects that should not be touched on. They absolutely went for it.
Well, I mean, her friends were just awful. So was it Pope who called her pockmarked Sappho? Was it him?
Yes, and there was pockmarked Sappho. I mean, things hotted up later on. I mean, the real kind of war of attrition was later on.
Was she aware that people were calling her this? Because she's writing to Pope. I mean, some of the best letters from...
Well, he fancies her, William. I reckon he fancies her. I do.
I think that Pope's real, you know, vitriol was reserved for later on when they really properly fell out in the 1730s. So we might come back to later on. And he certainly used her pockmarked face as a stick to beat her with, but that was not until later.
Well, and her husband, who, by the way, is going to very soon become the ambassador to Constantinople, says, "When you know, I should be overjoyed to hear your beauty is much impaired. Could I be pleased with anything that could give you displeasure, for it would lessen your number of admirers?" I mean, he's a charmer, isn't he?
Great.
She doesn't seem to have much of an eye for men, this woman. She just picks the... between Clotworthy Skeffington and Montague Wortley.
Her chance to not be married to someone who she actively disliked. And I think she just didn't know Wortley Montague very well beforehand. And he was cold. You know, he was a cold fish. And they never seemed to really have loved one another. Even in the very early days of their marriage, you see, she was always writing to him. You know, he sort of abandoned her up in the north. Her early letters are very, very sad. You know, he's always writing saying, "You never reply to my letters, and, you know, I'm lonely without you."
Well, so here she is in this kind of cracker's marriage with a not very nice man who is in 1716 to become the ambassador to, as they put it in those days, the sublime port of Constantinople. Join us after the break where we find out what Lady Mary made of her new life.
Welcome back to Empire, where we're talking to the wonderful Katie Hickman about Lady Mary Wortley Montagu.
And just as we come back, her husband, who we all hate, has been made the ambassador to the Ottoman Empire, to Istanbul. She has to get there, though, doesn't she? And that's not like just catching, you know, a flight. It takes a while.
It was an incredibly...
She lands at Rotterdam, that's the initial...
Dangerous journey. Rotterdam, then they made their way over Europe to Vienna. And she spent quite a lot of time in Vienna amongst the ladies, you know, writing wonderfully well about their monstrously large headdresses that were a yard high and covered in gauze and the faces painted and everything. She writes really well about the court of Vienna.
She's a fantastic writer. This is the first thing we should say.
She's a wonderful writer, yeah. We should just actually say, possibly at this point, that, you know, that they are allegedly letters. They're not really letters at all. These were, she used the letters that she wrote home to her friends and to her family, but they were heavily edited, intercut with sections from her journal. You know, she really crafted that what we have as apparent letters were crafted in it. They're highly, you know, a lot of artifice went into creating them.
Will you read a little bit of that journey, please? Because she does make this rather, again, you're very wisely reminded, this is the time of the Habsburgs. This is the time of great political flux and a time of war. So she has to actually literally traverse a battlefield, a freshly made battlefield. And what
were her impressions? Absolutely. So she's told by everyone in Vienna that, you know, the cold is going to kill her on the way down through the Balkans. So she's in quite a sort of heightened state of fear. And one of the first things she comes across after she's left Vienna is the site of the Battle of Peterwardein, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it, which was the site of Prince Eugen's great victory over the Turks. And she wrote, "This little digression has interrupted my telling you. We passed over the fields of Karlowitz, where the last great victory was obtained by Prince Eugen over the Turks. The marks of that glorious bloody day are yet recent, the field being strewed with the skulls and carcasses of unburied men, horses and camels. I could not look without horror on such numbers of mangled human bodies and reflect on the injustice of war that makes murder not only necessary but meritorious."
This is a moment when the Ottoman Empire is beginning to sink before the power of resurgent Europe. We've seen the Ottomans expand into Europe at the beginning of this series, but this is now the moment of the beginning of the contraction. And she's walking into the Ottomans at a time when they are beginning to be on the back foot.
And probably a little suspicious of Western powers. I mean, it's her husband's job, Katie, isn't it, to try and negotiate a position for Britain or an end to the Austro-Turkish war. That's the mandate that he's gone with.
Yes, that's exactly right. So the Austrians were committed by treaty to support the Venetian Empire, and the Turks were at war with the Venetians. So, you know, it was everyone got involved. And the British didn't want the Austrians to be involved because they wanted Austria to be available to help them, you know, against the French. So there was a lot of, you know, kind of jockeying for position.
So it's three-dimensional chess that...
Yes, absolutely. But so she made her way from Vienna all the way down the Balkans across the scene of devastation. The Turks gave them, you know, almost a regiment of Janissaries to go with them. Something like 500 men went with them on this journey.
And she writes beautifully about how these Janissaries scour the landscape, and these poor peasants in Serbia who've only got a couple of sheep and a chicken between them to keep them from starvation. The Janissaries just hoover them all up without even finding out who owns them and take everything.
Absolutely, yes, like a swarm of locusts going before it. And she feels, you know, quite unusually for an 18th century aristocrat, she really feels the pain of these poor peasants who absolutely everything is taken from them, and obviously no hope of any recompense at all.
This is what is so wonderful about her, is that I think that, you know, despite the kind of the name and all the aristocratic background, she is a writer like Jane Austen who immediately talks to us today. She's a feminist. She's intelligent. She's well-read. She's open to all things, and she doesn't judge anyone.
And makes up her own mind. Yeah, happy to fly against, you know, that's it, fly against public opinion. Yeah.
I think that's exactly what is so incredibly refreshing about her, is that she, it doesn't, you know, and all the way through her letters, she keeps, you know, she's obviously, there's been a lot already written about the Ottoman Empire because people are fascinated by it. And there are these books of travels that exist. And she keeps saying, well, don't listen to them. They don't know what they're talking about.
They don't know what they're talking about. She's particularly hesitant for somebody called Paul Reichardt, doesn't she, who's another British diplomat. Says, I don't know what empire he's visited, but nothing he said rings true at all to me.
Yes,
said.
Forget him. And with some justification, one of the things that is so interesting about the way she writes is that she has this knowledge of the female world, the knowledge of the harems and the hammams and so forth, that male writers have been very keen to, you know, put into their books of voyages, but of course they do it from from hearsay, not from first person
hearsay
experience.
And fantasy. And she meets the women, and she goes wonderfully into a Turkish bath, and she actually describes the scene of an entire room full of naked Ottoman women, which is something that all these painters have been busy painting without actually seeing. And she actually sees it. Yeah.
So this is the bit you've all been waiting for, the Turkish bath number. So and it is a completely fabulous description. So I'm going to read you a little bit. So this was actually in Sofia, which then was part of the Ottoman Empire. And she writes, "The first sofas were covered with cushions and rich carpets on which sat the ladies, and on the second, their slaves behind them, but without any distinction of rank by their dress, all being in the state of nature. That is, in plain English, stark naked, without any beauty or defect concealed. Yet there was not the least wanton smile or immodest gesture among them. They walked and moved with the same majestic grace which Milton describes of our general mother," by which she means Eve. And I should say that at this point, she is herself fully clothed, because, of course, it's not in her cultural, makeup to take her clothes off. So she goes on to say, "The lady that seemed the most considerable amongst them entreated me to sit by her and would fain have undressed me for the bath," because she was fully clothed. "I excused myself with some difficulty. They being, however, all so earnest in persuading me, I was at last forced to open my shirt and show them my stays, which satisfied them very well. For I saw they believed I was so locked up in that machine that it was not in my own power to open it, which contrivance they attributed to my husband."
So they can join the We Hate Edward gang.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So they think she's in some sort of chastity belt or something. Yeah. Brilliant.
So it was a corset.
It was her stays and her corset. So if you can imagine how unbelievably hot she must have been, apart from anything else, I'm sure you've both been into Turkish, into hammams. I mean, the temperature gets very, very, very great indeed. So she was sitting there sweating profusely and refusing to take her clothes off. But it's not a titillating description at all. She's just telling it like it is. Very matter of fact. That if you go into a hammam, that is exactly what you find.
What I was very impressed by her writing is that it's both very, very smart. For example, her political analysis. She says, and most modern historians would completely agree with her, that the government in the Ottomans, the real power lies partly with the ulema, with the Islamic establishment, and partly with the janissaries, not with the sultan. And of course, this is proved right in the years to come, because you see endless janissary revolts during the 18th century, and sultans deposed by them. And she preempts this with this observation. She understands politically from her travels and her conversations with people exactly what's going on. But she also has an eye for beauty. She understands the beauty of a Turkish garden. Yes. She talks about how much Turks value their gardens and the value put on a good gardener, for example.
Absolutely. And of course, this was the tulip age.
A great moment in Ottoman art and in Ottoman gardens.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, she was completely alive to the aesthetic, the aesthetics of it. And she really fell in love with Turkey, I think. She writes with great, it's a sort of quite joyful and sort of, she's come from this rather repressed world, or repressed for a woman, with the things that women were able to do. And she's sort of liberated by being away from everything, as all the best travel writers write in those.
Yeah, she's a travel writer, but she's also, as William was saying, just an unembellished journalist as well, because she writes, and I wonder whether she knows how important what the observations are that she's making, because she often comments, "Don't believe what people are saying to you about the Ottomans, because this is a really mixed society." She says about, sort of some of the most powerful people here in Istanbul are the Jews. And, that wouldn't happen in our country. She sort of flagrantly comes out with political comments.
She also is very good in her way that she goes against Western preconceptions about how oppressed Islamic women are.
Yes.
And this is something which is as needed today as it is in her time.
And
she describes
say?
How that they are much more free than her, she says, that she cannot leave her house without someone seeing her or following her or knowing where she's going. But she says that counterintuitively, that wearing a veil or being in burqa allows anonymity and allows the women to pursue affairs and do whatever they like without their husbands being able to follow them.
Do you want to read a bit, Katie?
Yes, absolutely I will, because she writes really, really well about this. And as you say, she was sort of, this is an example, a very good example of how she didn't take anything that she'd previously read. You know, she wasn't influenced by anything. She just wrote what she herself experienced. She was completely clear-minded about what she saw. And of the liberty of Turkish women, which she writes about a lot, this is a good example. She says, 'Tis very easy to see that they have more liberty than we have. No woman of what rank soever being permitted to go in the streets without two muslins, one that covers her face, all but her eyes, and another that hides the whole dress of her head and hangs halfway down her back. You may guess, then, how effectually this disguises them, that there is no distinguishing the great lady from her slave, and 'tis impossible for the most jealous husband to know his wife when he meets her, and no man dare either touch or follow a woman in the street. This perpetual masquerade gives them entire liberty of following their inclinations without danger of discovery. And she ends by saying, upon the whole, I look upon the Turkish women as the only free people in the empire. So she was very, very impressed by what she saw.
That's such an interesting observation, because she also talks about the Sultan being a slave of the Janissaries.
Absolutely. She is completely forensic in the way that she drills down into things. So she can see that women are, you know, there is an aspect of freedom associated with them wearing veils, but she also notices how financially independent these women are. And I mean, compared to her, she said to herself when she was getting married that, you know, people in my way are like, you know, she felt that she was like a slave. Whereas Turkish women or Ottoman women, if they have any kind of estate, it's in their hands and they are free to dispose of their money as they wish. Mm. And so they are patrons of the arts and all those things that they are able to do because they have control over their own money, which in the 18th century in Britain was you had no control over your finances whatsoever if you were a woman.
Yeah, and also arguably because she's in this women's realm, you know, where we've talked about this before with Bethany Hughes. You know, this is the place of gossip and intrigue and exchanging information. I mean, she's never allowed in the room where the men are talking about matters of state, but arguably she knows a lot about what's going on in the state. If her husband would only listen to her, I mean, goodness knows if he did listen to her or ever gave any credence to what she had to say.
What I think is very interesting is to compare her observations to a French Huguenot travel writer. And again, both of them in different ways are countering this idea that's already very prevalent in Western writing about the Islamic world, that it's a land of oppression, that it's a land of slavery. She's saying the women are free. At the same time, this Huguenot writer, Monsieur de la Motte, writes, there is no country on earth where the exercise of all sorts of religions is more free and less subject to being troubled than in Turkey.
Yes.
So at the same time, you have these two writers, very different, pointing out that the Ottoman Empire is quite different to the spectre of violence that has been haunting Europe and about which so many myths have grown up.
Yes, and they were the sort of bogeymen, weren't they? You know, beating at the walls of Vienna, are going to take everything over. But actually what she finds is this incredibly cultured, civilized, beautiful way of life.
And she's writing these letters, as you say, these curated, deliberate. I mean, they are chapters of a travelogue in all but name. Are they, do you know, being circulated around the court in England? Because Princess Caroline is her great patron back at home. I mean, do we know how people were receiving the stuff that she was writing?
They were to some degree public, you know, pieces of writing, because you wrote a letter to somebody and you knew that they were going to be circulated. But they were only circulated amongst the people that you knew. So the question of whether they were going to be published or not, you know, that was something that a woman, you know, it was a sort of, it considered a scandalous thing and not something that if you were, certainly if you were not someone like Lady Mary and an aristocrat, you didn't want to sully yourself by going into the public sphere and being actually published in the way that we would understand that today. But the letters certainly would have had a much wider readership than just the person to whom they were addressed, that's for sure.
Okay, so look, so she's gleaning all this information as an autodidact, also rather charmingly, she's learning the language, and in some of her letters she writes vocabs and translations for people back at home. But then something, again, it's smallpox that changes the course of her life again. And tell us what happens. This is now, this time she's had it.
She's already had it. She nearly died, and her brother did die. And she notices that smallpox is not something that is feared in the Ottoman Empire. And the reason for this is that they have a way of what she calls engrafting. So it's like a form of inoculation that happens within the women's quarters. And if you like, I can read. Would you like me to read this?
I would love it.
It's actually a rather famous passage in one of her letters, which is about this procedure that happens. And she writes, "There is a set of old women who make it their business to perform the operation. Every autumn in the month of September, when the great heat is abated, people send one another to know if any of their family has a mind to have the smallpox. They make parties for this purpose, and when they are met, commonly 15 or 16 together, the old woman comes with a nutshell full of the matter of the best sort of smallpox and asks what veins you please to have opened. She immediately rips open that you offer to her with a large needle, which gives you no more pain than a common scratch, and puts into the vein as much venom as can lie upon the head of her needle, and after binds up the little wound with a hollow bit of shell." And then she goes on to say that the fever begins to seize them after about the eighth day, and they keep to their beds for 2 days, very seldom as many as three. They very rarely have above 20 or 30 in their faces, by which she means actual, pock marks. Yeah, which never mark. And in 8 days' time, they are as well as before their illness. There is no example of anyone that has died of it. And you may believe I am well satisfied of the safety of the experiment, since I intend to try it on my dear little son. And she did. She went ahead. It was an incredibly brave thing to do, because smallpox was such a huge killer in Europe. So the idea that you might deliberately try to expose your only child at that point.
Your male heir called Edward, 5 years old.
Your male heir, yeah. So very, very important. She had another child, a daughter who was born out there, but the male heir was everything. And it was successful, and he recovered along with everybody else and therefore had immunity.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting though, that, I mean, because little boy, I mean, I think this is just a really interesting moment in her life. The little boy is there, there's an elderly woman. They were normally Christians who came over and did this walnut shell engraftment, so they'd have a bit of pus in their little walnut shell, and they would take a little knife and they would make a little, they would say, which vein would you like us to do? And the child would be held down, and her little Edward just flipped out, wouldn't let them close to him, because they looked different. They were different. They were scary, and they didn't speak the same language. So there's the embassy doctor, a surgeon called Charles Maitland, who's there to observe. And he then steps in and says, okay, let me help. I've got a lance and I will make a scratch, and let me do it then, because the child will be a bit calmer. And that's all he does. I mean, it's basically their operation, it's their idea. But he then will go and take quite a lot of credit for this, you know, that he's the man who sort of does the engraftment.
This would have huge repercussions, you know, later on when she returns to London. So they returned in 2 years later in 1718. In 1721, there was a huge smallpox epidemic, and lots of Lady Mary's friends and acquaintances all died in it. And, you know, London's social life, almost as important, came to a complete standstill. And so she decided that she was going to publicly inoculate her daughter. She was going to try to bring this procedure and show her fellow countrymen this procedure and how it could work. So she arranged to have her little daughter inoculated, and the same doctor, Dr. Maitland, stepped up and performed it.
But in front of an audience, they were like an audience.
They had witnesses, because people were so sort of, you know, they couldn't believe that someone would deliberately do this, expose their own little child. I think she was only about three.
She was three, and she didn't ask Edward. She just did it behind Edward's back.
She just did it. Gives you some idea of the state of their marriage.
So there's an audience there of blue bloods who are watching this procedure, and the little girl has an engraftment, and they all witness. They see that she is ill for a little while, and then she gets better, and then it becomes all the rage in the court, to the point where the Princess of Wales decides to do her own children.
The Princess of Wales decides that she's going to inoculate her own children, but not until they've done a curious thing. It's very controversial, this whole engraftment. And so before that happens, they decide that they're going to engraft some some criminals in
Newgate prison.
They're three women and three men. I don't know whether they volunteered or whether they were volunteered.
What do you reckon?
And they engrafted these six people, and all of them survived, and then they were pardoned. So they got out. It was their get out of jail card. And so at that point, Princess Caroline decides that she's going to inoculate her two little girls.
Well, I thought actually before they did that, there's a bit more horror in this story. So they do the Newgate prisoners, who maybe have some agency, but then they do a bunch of orphans.
Yes, they do a bunch of orphans. Orphans in the St. James's area, so right round St. James's Palace, they inoculate these children. And the thing that made me laugh so much is that then these children, when they've recovered, are then their notices appear in the press saying, these children are, you know, on display for you to come and inspect them if you want. These are the survivors of this procedure of engraftment, she calls it. So if you wanted to, you could go and you could, have a look and see for yourself that they were hale and hearty and unmarked by the pox. And I think there was something, even the, schoolboys in, there was a huge kind of warfare in the media, which interestingly split down party lines. This has, there's a modern kind of tale in this. So anyone who was associated with the court, they approved of this procedure, but the opposition parties and the press associated them were furiously anti.
Were they anti-vax?
Anti-vaxxers. Wow. Anti-vaxxers, wow. Down party lines. So if you were a Whig, you thought it was great. If you were a Tory, you thought it was not disgraceful. Mm.
What is interesting is that this is one of the last moments that you find Europe learning science from the Islamic world. This has been going on since the 12th century when astronomical tables are brought in from Spain and so on, and Europe is learning mathematics, science, and astronomy from Islam. And by the 18th century, the academic boot is now on the other foot, and the direction of learning is beginning to be west to east. And you're finding the same in India, that there's, for example, there's an amateur astronomer called Thomas Dean Pierce, exactly the same time in Calcutta. And he's hanging out with Muslim astronomers in Lucknow. And he finds they know about, is it an extra moon of Venus? But there's some detail that the Islamic astrologers know in the mid-18th century that's not yet known in Europe until Herschel builds a Bennett telescope. But by the 19th century, this will have ceased to have happened. And it's, again, one of these transition moments where the Ottomans are teaching the West something.
Yes. But if I can just add in there, that one of the things that made this procedure controversial was that it was considered to have been sort of, not that it wasn't scientific, but that this was a folk remedy. This was done by little old women in a harem. I mean, this is how it was interpreted in the West, that it was done by little old women in a harem. And so why should we, even the people who were in favour of the idea of you could see empirically that it worked. But it came via women and it came via foreigners. And so there was, in this sort of pamphlet war, and it really was a vicious war, there was one, shall I just read this one little thing, this man, William Wagstaff, because this just shows you the degree of racism and misogyny that there was surrounding this particular thing, which had been, introduced, the two principal women, Lady Mary and Princess Caroline. So there was a female aspect to this that the men didn't like. And this man called William Wagstaff, who was a medic, wrote this pamphlet, and he wrote, "Posterity perhaps will scarcely be brought to believe that an experiment practiced only by a few ignorant women amongst an illiterate and unthinking people should of a sudden and upon slender experience so far obtain in one of the politest nations in the world, capital letters, as to be received into the royal palace." There was a lot going on in the debate. It wasn't just about the science of it.
And years later, Edward Jenner does the same thing. When he takes cowpox, engrafts himself after seeing how his milkmaids are faring and not getting sick with smallpox, and then it's almost as if it's rediscovered and then it's acceptable. And I never knew about Lady Mary Wortley Montagu until I read your book that she had anything to do with this. To me, inoculation always starts with Jenner. I've never heard anything other than that.
Yes, well, there you go.
There is a whole world of things learnt by the West from the Islamic world, which are not attributed to the right sources.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time together. Can you just tell us sort of how does it all end? Feisty women never have lovely ends, I found. What happens to her?
No, alas and alack. And after this whole controversy about the smallpox, she was embroiled in yet another controversy because she fell out with Alexander Pope, who'd been her great friend and her great sort of literary collaborator. And no one quite knows what it was that made them fall out. There was one theory that he had declared passionate love to her and she laughed in his face. Pope was had a curvature of the spine. He was a very small man. He was only 4'6". And so obviously his height was a huge issue for him. You know, she's alleged to have laughed in his face and he took great umbrage, but nothing was ever written down. There's another theory, I think probably put around by Pope, that she had borrowed some sheets from his house and had returned them unlaundered. Why this would spark a huge literary, vicious campaign against one another. And she was very damaged by the sort of, you know, the crossfire that followed. So Pope really let rip, and he described her in the most horrible ways in several of his poems, including his great satirical poem, the Dunciad, where he lampoons, you know, a number of people, not only her, but he portrays her as being, you know, like a prostitute who's given venereal disease to her lover. I mean, you know, they didn't pull their punches in any way at all, and she hit back anonymously because, you know, as a lady, she wasn't supposed to go public, but it really did affect her reputation, and she ended up going to Europe. She ended up going and living in Venice, amongst other places, you know, on the continent, sort of getaway.
There are worse fates than ending up in
Venice.
There
are worse fates than that. Yeah. There are worse fates than that. And
if she'd been stuck with Clotworthy in Ireland.
Yeah, well, that would have been a lot worse. Yeah. But she sort of ends up in Europe sort of friendless and alone. And then when she does die, and some people have suggested she may have died of cancer, but then her daughter does this really unforgivable thing where she burns her journals.
Burns her journals, yes.
So then, you know, the journals are destroyed. They're gone. They're ashes. Any letters she can get hold of that her mother had, she burns those as well. But we still know about the letters. Why, Katie?
Because she had all this while. It was sort of 40 years since she'd been in Constantinople. All this time, she had kept the kind of literary draft of what became the letters. So it was the letters that had been reworked and then spliced in, were, you know, pieces from her diary and so forth. And she, you know, whether or not she intended it for publication isn't really known, but it was certainly in a very literary, you know, beautiful form, the form that we have it in now. So Edward Montagu died, and at that point she decided she was going to come back to England. En route, she was holed up for a while with this man called, a clergyman called Benjamin Sowerden, I think he was called. And she sort of lived with him for a while because her maid was ill, and so she had to, you know, make a pause in her journey. And she ended up giving him the manuscript of her letters, the letters that have come down to us, which is kind of a strange thing to do, because she didn't say to him, here's my manuscript, I hope you'll publish it after I'm dead. But she gave them to him nonetheless and came back to England and died very shortly after that. So Benjamin Sowerden was left with this extraordinary document, and he then went to her daughter, the very prim and proper Lady Bute, and they said, not on your life, you are not allowed to publish this. You know, this could damage us as a family. It's all very scandalous, you know, and they ended up buying the manuscript back from him. But unbeknownst, this is another kind of picaresque aspect of the tale. Apparently, on Benjamin Sowerden's return, he had lent this manuscript to two anonymous Englishmen, young Englishmen, who'd said, oh, please, can we just read it overnight? And they had gone and it must have taken them the whole evening, both of them. They copied down, they'd made a copy of it. And so, to the consternation of Lady Mary's family, this unauthorized version of her diaries appeared in print, which was the result of this copy that had been made. So it was just by the sheerest accident, really, that the whole thing wasn't
Thank
burnt,
God.
And we would never, yeah. and we would never have had it.
And then I think a great grandson produces a final edited edition, because I think there's several errors in the pirate edition, if you like. And so one of her descendants makes good in the end, and we do now have a final edition, which you can read. I recommend to anyone that has enjoyed this podcast that the Turkish embassy letters of Mary Wortley Montagu are published by Eland with an afterword by Deborah Murphy.
And if you want to read about Lady Mary and other women just like her, bloody minded, bloody difficult women, then Daughters of Britannia is for you by Katie Hickman.
By the great Katie Hickman. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Katie, for coming on. Oh, that was just wonderful.
Pleasure. Loved every minute of it. Thank you for having me.
That's all from me, Anita Arnand.
And me, William Dalrymple.